The army doesn't like more than one disaster in a day.
Looks bad in the newspapers and upset civilians at their breakfast.
I'm Bill Buford. Welcome to War Notes, a conflict podcast in which we will be taking a journey into history, discussing contemporary events, and even doing some conflict futurism. We'll be examining this violent and calamitous clash and collision between complex adaptive systems armed to the teeth to see who will prevail and see what it tells us about the human condition and why we can't stop. Okay, this is Bill, and welcome to episode 11 of War Notes, a conflict podcast. Continuing my Fixing Fight Club series, this one is called The Death of Manned Air Power. And what we will be discussing today is how to fix the U.S. Air Force. So with that, housekeeping as usual, I really appreciate folks corresponding with me. And I get quite gentlemanly responses to things, even in episode 7, where I said, kill the core. And I suggested that Uncle Sam's misguided children have seen their day, that it's time to play taps, and it's time for them to be retired, retire the colors, and everything like that. And not a lot of hate mail. So that was very pleasant. Again, I want to thank everybody for your solicitude. We are probably veering into the end of Fixing Fight Club. I think I might have one or two or three episodes in me, possibly, that will round out what I've been trying to do the entire effort since I started this late last year, was to take advantage of the new administration coming into power, who has hit the ground running in revising, fixing, in unscrewing so much that is so wrong with the government and the way it's behaved itself, arguably, for the past century and a half. I have great hope right now, administratively, technically, and operationally, that maybe the new Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, will surround himself with worthies and defense intellectuals who will take advantage of the opportunity they have before them to possibly refit, revise, and make more fit for purpose a Department of Defense that takes defense of the homeland much more seriously than it has in the past few decades, arguably since the end of World War II. Just a wee bit of history, and in the show notes, I provide plenty of references that one can go to if they want to do a lot more substantial drilling into what the U.S. Air Force is about, what it has been, how it got here, and what it portends to be in the future. Since the end of World War II, when the Army Air Forces were directly connected to the Army in 47-48, the United States Air Force separated itself from the U.S. Army, and during the Key West Agreement, much teeth were gnashed about what would happen as far as fixed wing and rotary wing aircraft. It turned out that the Air Force did say, yea and verily, U.S. Army, you may have rotary wing aircraft and a small fleet of fixed wing. Yea and verily, as a result of the revolt of the admirals in the late 40s, the U.S. Air Force said, and they're speaking on competing grounds here in the respective services, yea and verily, U.S. Navy, you may have both fixed wing and rotary wing aircraft. And of course, the U.S. Air Force, from mud to space, has fixed wing, rotary wing aircraft, manned, unmanned, and all the modalities. It's the world's largest air force. It is the second largest branch of the U.S. Armed Forces. The strength that I'm going to talk about is the active duty airmen, the reserve airmen, and the Air National Guard airmen. And so I think the active duty is 323, could be 320 this year. The strength goal was 320, so we'll see if they make it or not during the year. Reserve airmen, there's approximately 67,000. Air National Guard, remember, the bifurcation here when it comes to U.S. military linguistics is that the reserves are still officially tethered not to the states, but to the armed service itself. And the National Guards are state entities that are run by an adjutant general who is appointed by the governor to oversee those local military forces to the state. And in that case, Air National Guard airmen, their strength is approximately 107,000 from Alaska to Florida and everywhere in between, to include Hawaii, of course. For the fiscal year 2025 budget, the request is approximately $217 billion, which is a 1.1% increase over the fiscal year 2024 budget request. DAF, the Department of the Air Force, they play an integral role achieving the four priorities outlined in the National Defense Strategy. Just this would be the quadrennial reviews that occur where they revision and reassess and reconstitute what the strategic and grand strategic imperatives of the United States will be. Those four things are defending the homeland, deterring strategic attacks, deterring aggression, and building a resilient joint force. Joint, of course, meaning going arm in arm, hand in hand in both peacetime and wartime with the other services in a peaceful fashion, at least this side of the firing line. Yes, I have taken a chainsaw to the other services in my analyses and recommendations, and I will not spare the Air Force in any fashion, one way or another. Those new to the podcast will not know this, but those who have been perennial listeners, I thank you for your solicitude, will know I was enlisted in the Navy, got my commission in the Army to avoid sea duty, and retired in 2003. And since that time, I have been contracting and being employed in various ways, capitalizing on my military talent stacks that I developed over that time. Now, the Air Force employs many aircraft to include legacy and cutting-edge aircraft. It has approximately, these are 2024 figures, 145 F-15 Eagles and 218 F-15 Echo Strike Eagles, which are improved versions, and even the F-15 EX, of which only 8 are operational, where they're really trying to press the edge of the envelope on probably one of the finer fighter aircraft that we have had in the inventory since the 1960s. The F-16 Fighting Falcon, it numbers at 726. It is the one that has the highest number of fighter aircraft. It's a multi-role fighter, as are the others. F-22 Raptor, apparently there are 185 of those in the inventory. I don't know whether there are going to be other block upgrades or anything. And then, of course, we have Fat Amy, the F-35 Lightning, which I have taken to the woodshed as a singular technological and extraordinarily expensive failure, pursuing many things that would go awry. First, adopting stealth, of course, which for near peer and peer conflicts. By the way, I'm starting to think that I should get rid of that term near peer, because according to the caterwauling and complaining of the Navy and the treatment of its carrier group by the Houthis in Yemen in the Red Sea, It apparently suffered the most severe naval combat since World War II. I am paraphrasing. So there we have not a near peer, not a peer country with the Houthis in Yemen, but what one would call a third world country plus that has a lot of peer partners among the BRICS nations like Iran, China, and Russia taking advantage of that, much like the Russians have taken advantage of the Ukraine as a working laboratory to see how they can kill the West's exquisite systems and platforms. Again, I am on a jeremiad against exquisite platforms, because I think for the most part, that is not how you're going to win peer warfare. And unfortunately, as with so many services and so many armies and so many martial complexes in the West, we continue to fight the last war, in this case, World War II, when it comes to the U.S. Air Force, as with the Navy and its carrier fixation. As I have mentioned before, the carrier is the crossbow and chariot of the 21st century. Fat Amy and its configurations, that would be the Alpha Bravo and Charlie. The Bravo and Charlie models are VTOL and STOL models that are designed for carrier or LPD operations or short landing and takeoff fields of one type or another. I have a blog that I maintain over at the Libertarian Institute, at which I am a fellow. And on that blog, five times a week, the F-35 provides me with much ammunition and frivolity when it comes to criticizing that program from NAEP to CHAPS, because it fails from a budget perspective, it fails from a reliability perspective. It fails in finally delivering an aircraft that has been envisioned since the turn of the century that fails to live up to what it can do. It certainly can't be a multi-role fighter, and it certainly isn't going to be a good interim fighter until the NGAD comes out, which is the next generation air dominance fighter. I did discuss that just recently, and that is going to be a problematic and probably chaotic program that will not deliver what they promise now, much as with all the exquisite systems and platforms that the U.S. Armed Forces have been bilking the U.S. taxpayer out of for the last 40 years. I will tell you, for instance, and these aren't the Air Force variants, the Navy and Marine Corps variants of the F-35 are the Bravo and Charlie, which have stunted ranges as a result of having to have fuselages that are reinforced for STOL and VTOL landings on carriers, beaches, whatever the case may be. And by the way, their operational readiness rate is, if you have 100 of these aircraft that happen to be in your area for use in a war, you will have a 30% effectiveness rate on them across the board and declining. So I just think that the F-35 is hot garbage. Now, attack aircraft, there's the A-10 Thunderbolt II and the AC-130 Ghost Rider. Those would be the Juliet variants, and then the uniform variant, which will probably be the last AC-130s, these gunships, to come out on the redoubtable, estimable, and fantastic aircraft, the C-130, which has been probably, next to the B-52, one of the most successful post-World War II platforms in fixed-wing aviation that the U.S. has developed since that time. Now, that Ghost Rider, they've got approximately 30 of them, and that will probably be in both the Juliet and the coming uniform variants, and the A-10 Thunderbolt. Now, look, I spent some time overseas. I spent some time in Afghanistan. We always loved to see the Flying Cross, an amazing aircraft. I had the opportunity on two occasions to see it in action on the ground while I was in Afghanistan. It is a sight to behold, and the sounds that it makes are absolutely incredible. And this comes from a guy who spent some time in the Army, and I was around before they decommissioned them, the 20 millimeter Vulcans, because they are 30 millimeter Gatlings on the A-10, but we used to have both towed and self-propelled 20 millimeter Vulcan anti-aircraft weapon systems in the U.S. Army, and these would sound the same as that, sort of like ripping sailcloth, much like the MG-34s and MG-42s that the Germans fielded so successfully in a smaller caliber, of course, in World War II. But I have bad news for you. Remember what I said about pier, near pier, and I'm probably just going to start using the term pier, and now I can even say that the Houthis in Yemen could be considered to be a peer parallel in certain sectors and respects in the way they conduct their warfare. What you've noticed in the Ukraine with the Su-25 Frogfoot is that they will rarely send them forward of the forward line of troops, the flot, because they are simply going to be shot down. The halcyon days of the A-10, for which I have the greatest respect as a successful airframe that was a creature of its time, designed as a tank killer to just mow down the mass tank formations of the Warsaw Pact and the Soviet forces in the 1980s, Fairchild provided us with a wonderful aircraft that could also transition to take over for the A-1 Sky Raider and all of its variants from the Vietnam War, to provide close air support beyond tank killing for suppression, neutralization, or destruction of enemy forces that tended to be behind reverse military slopes and places where either indirect fire was not capable, was not available, or direct fire could not service that target. The A-10s saved the day many a time in third world countries like Afghanistan and like Iraq. But again, they could be delicate too, despite that titanium tub that those pilots are in. The point that I'm making is that as much as I was against 5 years ago decommissioning the A-10, the A-10, when it comes to peer warfare, will not have a place. And one of the reasons it won't have a place, and here we are, I've just gone over the fighter aircraft, we're covering the attack aircraft. Attack aircraft tends to be ground attack, is that the era of manned combat aircraft is closed. It is over. It saddens me. It breaks my heart. Much as my notions in episode 7, where I had to say it is time to play taps for the U.S. Marine Corps and it is time to fold whatever devil dogs are available as trigger pullers into Army units. Let's do that because it's time to case the colors. In this case, it is time to case the colors of manned combat aviation. Manned combat aviation started maybe 1914, 1915, and now we are 110 years plus into the era of manned combat aviation, and it is coming to a close. Because as I've emphasized in other podcast episodes, not only is this the age of missiles, but this is the age of unmanned air modalities. In this case, it is an extraordinary amount of money to put $100 million, give or take $10 million, whatever you believe as far as the cost of the F-35, for instance, and put it up there where it is subject to being intercepted either by SAFADS, which is small arms air defense, or by passive acquisition systems like Stingers and the Russian equivalents thereof, or missiles that are designed to go from ground or maybe another aircraft, and that aircraft doesn't have to be manned, and strike that $100 million aircraft out of the air. Now, that's a complication in several respects. Number one, you're spending a hell of a lot of money for that. Number two, you must have combat search and rescue assets available, and the Air Force is second to none with pararescuemen, PJs, CCTs, and the special operations components that no one on Earth has the capability to match. But if you don't have combat search and rescue capabilities, for instance, what happened in Serbia, what we've seen happen on very few occasions in Afghanistan and Iraq, because those weren't really air wars in which air domination and air supremacy in that very limited scoping was the province of the United States. That will not be the case in a peer war, but no pilot or naval aviator in his right mind is going to go forward in a combat aircraft, whether a bomber or an attack aircraft, a fighter or whatever, where he doesn't have an unconscious or conscious assurance from his chain of command that those guys in their MH-60s, those pararescuemen, those PJs, those very talented medics and rescue folks and trigger pullers, by the way, who will come to your crash site or wherever you happen to have landed under canopy and get you out of there. That can be guaranteed for the most part, but peer warfare is going to change that, because what peer warfare is also going to do is it's going to make not only fixed-wing manned aircraft, but rotary-wing helicopters manned aircraft to be a rarer modality than we are used to. Now, the Air Force has bombers like the B-52 were the last one. I think it was a Gulf or hotel, came off the factory floor in 1962, which means that you can have squadron commanders in the U.S. Air Force who are younger than the birthday of the aircraft they may be flying in their squadron. Air Force has 76 of these. They've done a number of revisions, upgrades. You can see that in the new prop modalities and things like that. B-2 Spirit, they have 20 of those. They did have 21, but one crashed. The B-1 Lancer, the Bone, they have 45 of those. Remember these operational readiness rates. Keep in mind what I've always said, one-third, one-third, one-third. I'll bet one-third of those buffs, the B-52s are available. Same thing applies to the B-2 Spirit, although I'd put it at one-quarter. And then when it comes to the B-1 Lancer, which for the most part has been a very successful tarmac ornament, but it has been plagued by engineering and technical difficulties for the longest time, and it's being phased out. There are 40 B-1Bs that are operational, and that's going to be in 2025 because they're going to retire 5 of these. Which brings me to something that I hinted at in the episode in which I discussed Fixing Fight Club 21st Century Nuclear Renaissance, or Renaissance, as John Cleese would tell us, episode number 5 in this Fixing Fight Club series, where I talked about the fact that the Air Force is in charge of the three legs of the nuclear deterrent and the nuclear weapon systems for the United States, being ballistic missile submarines, missiles and stationary silos, in this case, the Minuteman III, and a bomber force that could deliver nuclear weapons. Now, as far as prior to the year 2000, one could comfortably say that with sufficient escort sending B-52s, B-21s, and I won't even mention the B-1 because they're so bloody unreliable, you could say or make the case for gravity bombs at the time, of which there are currently 400 in the inventory effective January 2025. The F-15 and the F-16 can carry these. Of course, those would be smaller. Apparently, of those 400 nuclear gravity bombs, approximately 350 of those are deployed at NATO bases in Europe. But here we are, after the year 2000, and I do think that nuclear cruise missiles are viable, launched from a B-52, for instance. But I think because we are smack dab in the middle of a very ubiquitous and dense missile age, the very notion of sending B-2s, which can be detected despite being stealthy, because that's the way long-wave radar works, is that when B-2s and B-52s are sent to do that very thing, that is a one-way ticket for those crews in this missile environment. As a matter of fact, I could make the case to get rid of manned bombers altogether for a variety of technical and military reasons. When it comes to AWACS, which would be the early warning systems and airborne control systems that are employed, the E-3 Sentry, there's 15 of those, the E-4 Night Watch. Command and control, of course, is absolutely critical. These would be the quarterbacks if there are small or large formations of aircraft operationally, operating a squadron level or larger armadas. And these would be the ones that would keep an eye on what's going on the horizon. They would cue on incoming. And then in the targeting methodology between detection and declaration, they would look at all of these targets with numbers assigned, and they would say friendly, neutral, commercial, enemy, and assign targeting priority of work to the aircraft that are there. Now, the F-35 does boast a system that allows it to do a lot of what the AWACS does. But yet another problem when it comes to manned aircraft is you must fly that aircraft, you must fight that aircraft, and this whole notion of loyal wingmen, when you would have quarter size, fifth size, whatever those scaled size drones would be, that would either emulate the shape of an F-35 or an F-16 or be completely independently engineered and brand new variations on unmanned aircraft, what they call unmanned combat aircraft, which would be UCAVs. What would happen with this, if you're ferrying an aircraft, it's one thing. But if you're in combat, if combat in the air, and I am not a pilot nor an aviator, if combat in the air is anything like being a ground combatant, it means that you have your hands full with your unconscious competence, battle drills, the tactics and techniques and procedures, your standing operating procedure, and all of these things that are going through your mind when you're on a two-way range, that it would make it cognitively impossible to handle these loyal wingmen, unless they are semi-autonomous or autonomous and they've been trained before, so that in the very moment that you are engaged in combat, you are not only fighting your aircraft, but also these loyal wingmen. I have to be convinced of the veracity and provenance of the possibility of that happening. The electronic warfare inventory of the U.S. Air Force numbers maybe 15 aircraft, and that would be the EA-37 Bravo, the EC-130H Compass Call, and the EC-130 Commando Solo, which is a PSYOP aircraft, and those aren't employed very much at all. As far as reconnaissance aircraft, to me, what I love about the reconnaissance aircraft is that you're finding a lot of unmanned modalities. And for the past two decades, I think that the Air Force has sort of mastered that. That has been the place that they've really successfully integrated intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, third-party targeting, and even kinetic modalities where they could fire missiles from aloft from long loiter aircraft that are worked from CONUS by guys in flight suits sitting in chairs comfortably in air conditioning in various places across the United States. Some of those airframes are long in the tooth, like the U-2, of which they have 27. And then, of course, they've got the P-9 and the rivet joint. The RC-135 rivet joint is really interesting because what it does is a lot of very sophisticated technological and technology vacuuming when it goes aloft that provides a lot of what's called electronics intelligence and signals intelligence, which is ELINT and SIGINT, and on occasions, measures and signals intelligence, which is MASINT. And now we come to tankers, from which I draw great concern. We have something called the KC-135. 376 are available now. The operational readiness rate sits at approximately 60 to 70%, according to the U.S. Air Force itself. The last airframe that came out of the factory, much like the B-52, was in the late 60s for the KC-135. Unfortunately, Boeing has the KC-46 Pegasus contract to succeed the KC-135. It's called the KC-46 Alpha, of which there are 72 now that are operational. There's been some problems with these birds. Two of the problems are, number one, it leaks fuel. Another one of the problems is, and this just slays me when I was told that this had happened, is that normally in a KC-135, and I've been on several of those on very long cross-Pacific treks, what you do is you have the boom operator in the rear of the aircraft, and he's got eyes on organically of the aircrafts that he is servicing with his Dragoon fueling probes and such, where the young aviators and pilots line up with him to receive the refueling that they need to continue mission. Now, that's great. In the KC-46 Alpha, I don't know if this is because they never talk to refueling people or not, but apparently they have the boom operator in the cockpit with the pilot and co-pilot looking at a video. And I can tell you from several perspectives that that's simply the wrong answer. That doesn't give one the control of unconscious competence that one has when the boom operator is looking directly at the aircraft, not on a video screen with the lack of depth perception, but is observing it actually in the rear of the aircraft in communications with the pilot and co-pilot. And I had mentioned previous to this complaint that it leaks fuel. You know, when a boom operator is delivering fuel to refill the tanks of the aircraft, the hungry aircraft that have come behind the refueler to do this, and fuel leaks, that is something that is not encouraging for the receiver or the giver in this case. They need to fix both of these problems. I am not convinced the KC-46 will be a successful refueler. There are KC-130 refuelers, and there is an M designator for these. So if I say MC-130 or I say MH-60 or anything like that, all that means is that it's a special operations command or soft bird coming out of first or second special operations wing. For instance, you will find that with the old MH-53s, which were succeeded by the MH-60s, for the most part, when it comes to the Air Force, if they have a refueling probe on them, they're most likely special operations birds. Of course, I think by standards and SOP, most Navy birds have refueling probes for obvious purposes. The targets in the peer competition with Russia and or China, depending if PACOM clacks off or whatever may occur, you are going to be remiss if you don't consider that the threat in this case, the Chinese or the Russians, don't make your refueling fleet, if they're targeting manned aircraft and not the fighters, not the bombers, not the ELINT aircraft, not any of those, They're going to target the refuelers first, because if they can decimate the American refueling fleet, of which America has the largest on Earth by any stretch, orders of magnitude greater than any other force's refueling fleet capability, if they take that out, the ability of the Air Force to project power beyond CONUS is pretty much neutered. For transport aircraft, we have 52 C-5s, we have 23 C-12 Hurons, and those are pretty tiny. The Charlie 12 J's, those are pretty tiny too, and those are going out of the inventory at three. The C-17, 222 of those. Those can even be used for not only transportation of infantry fighting vehicles, large bodies of troops and such, but can also be used for delivering airborne troops. And when I discussed that in the episode concerning land warfare, I explained in detail why mass tactical static line parachute jumping is a 20th century phenomenon that should never be repeated in the 21st century for obvious reasons. There's other ash and trash among them for these onesies and twosies, but the big birds are going to be your C-130s. Your C-130 Hercules, C-130H in this case, 153 of those in the inventory. The C-130 Juliet Super Hercules is a modified tactical airlifter. It's at 198, and that's probably the maximum number of aircraft that they're going to deploy. There's an HC-130. There's 40 of those. It's also a Super Hercules. And then I mentioned the Mike series, in this case, the MC-130 Juliet, which are going to be the special operations birds, and they can be tankers also, 57 of those. And there's some other ones like the Uniform 28 Alpha Draco, but this is a small transport aircraft that's primarily used by U.S. Special Operations Forces in all of their flavors. As far as helicopters, the Pave Hawk, the HH-60, there's approximately 223 of those in a number of variations. There's the MH-139 Grey Wolf, 79 of those. UH-1s, the Hueys that you saw from Vietnam, 63 of those are still operational. And then there's the very ugly, unreliable, and unfit V-22 Osprey tilt rotor aircraft, which I recommend no one listening to this podcast ever get in one if it's going to go aloft. There are 52 of those, but I think it was the Marine Corps. I don't know if the U.S. Air Force also had the stand down because of the tremendous accident rate on these and reliability issues. I think as of the recording of this podcast episode, the V-22 Osprey fleet is still on stand down. I'm not going to talk about trainers. I'm just going to go directly to UAV. That will conclude our inventory of the U.S. Air Force. The MQ-9 Reaper, which is a tremendous long loiter asset, 244 of those. The Global Hawk, even longer ISR asset, 9 of those. 3,000 Ravens, those are small. The RQ-20 Pumas, there's 60 of those. And the RQ-170, which is for SIGINT and ELINT, that Sentinel is 20. Now, the Air Force is also responsible for the nuclear missile inventories, the Minuteman III, in the fixed silo configurations, and the gravity bombs that I mentioned, and a number of cruise missiles. Now, I talked about those in detail in Episode 5, Fixing Fight Club, 21st Century Nuclear Renaissance, and I have the most serious doubts that the Minuteman III inventory will be replaced by the prospective Sentinel on time and under cost. And also, it wasn't until 2019 that the Air Force, for all of those fixed silo configurations throughout the United States, stopped using 8-inch floppy disks to update signals for target verification and all the things administratively and operationally that go into having these Minuteman IIIs on standby in the silo. Now, there are a variety of munition types and multiple independent reentry vehicles that are on the bus at the top of these missiles once they reach the top of their rather steep parabola and tip over at apogee and then release what has been hypersonic inbound since the 1950s on all of these variants. Now, when it comes to purposeful, fit-for-purpose, hypervelocity weapons, the Air Force has spent about $10 billion on two programs that have simply not panned out in delivering a weapons system that is hypervelocity and works. There are approximately 400 Minuteman III missiles. There have been a variety of opinions on the reliability of these ancient and very finely maintained missile sets, because remember, for the most part, as far as we know, both underground and in the air nuclear testing by the United States has ceased since around 1992. Therefore, a number of these weapons one could call suspect, but if you have 400 Minutemen, and let's assume that one third of those get aloft and they are equipped with multiple munitions, one can shower the earth, primarily over China, Russia, or whatever country is targeted, with many nuclear weapons. Of course, that would be a sharing event in which, if we took on China, which is rapidly expanding its nuclear inventory, or Russia, which is rapidly expanding the technology of their present inventory, you discover that it is quite literally an arms race that has never stopped. Now, in this case, the U.S. Air Force also was caught by surprise, as I imagine they are caught by surprise in so many ways, by the Russian use of what's called the Oreshnik IRBM or ICBM. What this is it's simply taking an ICBM or an IRBM, tipping it conventionally, and then sending it into its steep parabola, hitting apogee, tipping over, and sending down multiple munitions or a single munition that has a conventional tip. As a matter of fact, that conventional tip simply has to be dense metal, because once it hits the ground, it is a non-nuclear event with nuclear effects, less radiations, because radiation, because it comes to a sudden stop and bleeds off that energy in a very catastrophic fashion. It harkens back to what was contemplated in the 50s and 60s with a notion called rods from gods, which would be these 9 to 21 foot titanium rods, maybe a foot across, that would be stationed on low Earth orbit platforms and just gripped and held up there. And then once a launch signal is received and they find themselves jetted into the right place, the arm simply releases it, and it uses the gravity well of the Earth to accelerate it to beyond Mach 5, Mach 7, Mach 8, possibly in excess of Mach 10. And then that conventional munition, in this case, a tungsten rod, would land where it is and cause tremendous non-radioactive damage. The Russians have mastered this. Now, there's also something called FOBS, which is Fractional Orbital Bombardment System, which is hyperglide and glide vehicles that would take a much more shallow parabola when launched from an aircraft or the ground, but they would reach it at speeds in excess of Mach 5. Mach 5 is customarily the departure point for calling something hypervelocity instead of simply velocity. By the way, folks always like to play the Guinness Book of World Records when it comes to this. So what is the fastest intercontinental ballistic missile in the world? That would probably be the DF-41, and it's capable of reaching speeds of Mach 25. That's 19,000 miles per hour with a range of 9,320 miles. All of this is prospective, of course, because none of these have been launched in wartime, and the only nuclear weapons employed have been gravity bombs circa 1945 in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So all of this, as scary as it is just grossly abstract in the way it's conducted. So there it is. That's the U.S. Air Force. I think it is a peer or peer minus force. I think that the fact that the pilot mafia, especially the fighter mafia, dominates the United States Air Force leads to fantastical and magical thinking that wants us to continue building manned aircraft when the 21st century will be the era of unmanned and robotic aircraft. Now, some of those will be exquisite. A lot of them will be expendable and attritable, but a lot of it's going to come down to affordable mass, which is going to be affordable mass in two variations: swarms that steer and swarms that steer ballistically. In this case, swarms that steer will be intelligent swarms, and we're not there yet. No one is there yet as far as finding a way to steer these in an integrated air and missile defense environment, or in aerial access, aerial denial, A2AD environment like the Chinese have on the Pacific coast, of how exactly these are going to behave and be effective in swarming behavior. We're at the cusp of that. Maybe we'll find out sometime soon. My most humble recommendation to the Air Force, because in this Fixing Fight Club series, one of my charters is to give my prognostications, forecasts, or recommendations of how we can fix what is a terminally ineffective set of organizations in the DoD. The short-term fix is we must freeze hiring, take a knee, reassess, reconstitute, reassess again, and then figure out what 21st century warfare is going to look like. And we have a lot of clues right now. And again, I'm repeating a notion that I've said throughout this series, which is that the DoD needs to take the second letter in their name seriously when it comes to defense, and make sure that if we come to our senses and become strategically and grand strategically sober and start to pay attention to being a regional hegemon instead of a global hegemon, which really fixes the mind when it comes to an effective and rational defense, that CONUS, Alaska, Hawaii, and American territories of interest in a very limited fashion have to become the number one priority for protection against incoming missiles, whether they're hypervelocity or not. Another recommendation that I think should take place immediately is that all THAADs, all Patriots, all missile units excepting MANPADS, which is man portable, like Stingers, things like that, all of those need to be removed to the Army and given to the Air Force in order to make the synchronization of fires more seamless and to lend the expertise of the Air Force to having that kind of knowledge and operational experience and situational awareness, and better yet, situational understanding of what has to be done in hasty and deliberate defense against incoming missiles. Believe it or not, when it comes to synchronization of fires, whether it's JADC2 or ABMS, which is the Air Battle Management System, they still haven't come to a conclusion on how to build a system that is architected so that the services themselves and then the services working with other services can coordinate fires in a rational, effective system like the Russians have done with their fire synchronization system. Now, if you're interested in a detailed explanation of what has to be done for rational fires coordination, integrated air and missile defense, I won't bother you here by rehashing what I said in episode 48, which was a CG excursion called Peer Strike ISR Complex, the Need for Rational Fires Coordination. I go in excruciating detail on how the Russians broke the code on this and how the U.S. and the West has certainly not. It is also time to completely renegotiate and reassess the need for our triad. In this case, having Boomer submarines, the SSBNs, the ballistic missile submarines. By the way, I suggest that we entertain SSDNs, which is drone submarines that would have drones available to them in swarm strength. That we've got the submarine boomers owned by the Navy, and then we've got the fixed silos with Minuteman III to be replaced by Sentinels. They anticipate the Sentinels replacing the Minuteman III in the 2030s. I wouldn't bet anything on that. And then, of course, you have the gravity bombs that I discussed and the cruise missiles, which would be better for the manned air crews. But I think the reassessment has to be this: B-52s, B-21s, the B-1B, the bone is just, it's such a piece of crap that it's probably going to be worked out of the system in the next 5 years because it's such a terrible aircraft as far as reliability is concerned. As I've mentioned before, I think the era of manned combat aircraft is over. I would include that subset of bomber aircraft to be the very same thing. Why would you send a crew of young men into the hazard over enemy territory, especially if they have to employ gravity bombs, God's help them, or cruise missiles, when the same thing could be done by an unmanned modality or a variety of unmanned modalities, and you could do it even cheaper than the other options that are available. In my mind, when it comes to fixed silo munitions like the ICBMs and the IRBMs and the Minuteman III and its variants, it is time to say, is that really a smart idea? Because if you don't think that all of those fixed silos, which have been around since the 1950s, haven't been registered, assessed, targeted to the finest degree by any of our malefactors around the planet who may want to lob a preemptive strike against them. It is a silly notion to have these because while some may go aloft, we know for certain that in a strike that is unexpected, probably a third of them will never leave their silos, but will be detonated in the silos along with the munitions that are sent after them. And now for my intermediate goal set and solutions that I would offer, I'm expecting that the hate will be brung on these. We need to phase out manned combat aircraft. I know that a lot of folks don't want to do that. We need to reassess all integrated air and missile defense, and by extension and aggregation, that means offensive operations too. There are these three notions that were entertained in the 20th century in which the Air Force said that they would have air supremacy, air dominance, and air superiority. The last one could be localized or global. Air supremacy would be that time in the 50s, 60s, and 70s where no one was a peer to U.S. aircraft, whether bomber or fighter. That ended in the 1980s. It ended 5 years after the fall of the wall. And once China entered the grand stage of strategic fencing and pugilism, what we discovered is that you couldn't get air supremacy ever again. The U.S. would never have that. The U.S. would never have air dominance. Air superiority, which means that it could be on par as a peer, it is a possibility, but becomes more and more regionalized, if not localized, with time. So we need to completely revisit what the Air Force is going to be designed to do. And among those things is ISR domination, mud to space, whether that's air breathing or non-air breathing. In other words, whether that's going to be terrestrial air breathing modalities like UAVs or satellites and such, and the intricate web thereof of them coordinating together. And we have to focus on that kind of ISR domination if America chooses the wrong path, in my estimation, which is remaining a global hegemon, because all of this becomes so much more achievable, easier, and less expensive if America finally resigns itself to being a regional hegemon and saving the requisite amount of money and, by extension, actually defending the people who put up all that money. I'd mentioned earlier about fire synchronization and air battle management systems and such. It is time for the U.S. Air Force and the Joint Forces to get their heads out of their asses and finally find a rational, effective regime for fire synchronization within the services connected to each other, and doing that at the operational strategic level seamlessly. Long-term goals, the missile inventory has to be completely recharacterized. We must get rid of some of these fixed missile sites that we have, the notion of Minuteman IIIs. We need to start concentrating on SSBN-delivered IRBMs, ICBMs, cruise missiles. I mentioned SSDNs, which would be drone swarm submarines that would launch swarms of them. We need to master hyperglide and glide vehicles to do fractional orbital bombardment systems properly, because if we don't do it, others will do it, like the Russians. We need to use the time in the achieving by the long term that integrated air and missile defense that is seamless and workable for defending the nation. And mid-course interceptors. The whole notion of a mid-course interceptor, and this is a multi-billion dollar program that the U.S. presently has that only employs 44 mid-course interceptors on the West Coast to intercept incoming, or maybe something that will come over the Arctic, which is the most viable way to attack the United States. What it means by mid-course when they say that is, do you recall when I said for IRBMs or ICBMs, steep parabola, they hit their apogee, they hit the highest altitude that they're going to be at, and then all of a sudden the nacelles open up and the munitions or the multiple independent reentry vehicles tip over and release their payloads. We need to find a way to intercept those incoming munitions. The reason why they call them mid-course interceptors is because the magic that they perform is that they intercept that bus just before it offloads, just before it tips, right then and there at that time. Imagine taking a racquetball and you have other racquetballs that are going around, and you must take that one racquetball, or by extension, four of them, and I'll tell you why, and you have to hit across a football field incoming balls that are headed your way that you just got a detection on, you just instantiated in your targeting methodology, a declaration that is a threat, and you have to intercept it before it gains speed. It's a wicked engineering and scientific problem to do this. There is a magic moment for the mid-course interceptors to get it, because once they assume hypervelocity in their steep parabola coming back down to Earth in the gravity well, whether they are terminally ballistic or terminally maneuverable, it is extraordinarily difficult to hit that with present technology. No one on the planet presently has the technology to intercept those two variations on hypervelocity munitions that are inbound. Now, mind you, we've spent billions of dollars on this mid-course interceptor that I'm talking about, and we only have 44 of them. And we have something in engineering and in military utility calculations and trades that we conduct to see what works, a probability of kill, which means that I have to send more than one missile after a missile or an object to ensure that I get it before it lands on my lap. In this case, with the mid-course interceptors, because of the problem set that I'm presented with, the best case scenario for the probability of kill, the PK, is going to be I must send four aloft to service one target and get a chance of hitting it, which means that if there's more than 11 inbound munitions, the mid-course interceptor, a magical and fantastical enterprise to start with, has 11 chances. And if there's more than 11 inbound, then we are well and truly fracked. So I think the Air Force owes us a lot of answers. I think that we need to completely reimagine and rethink the Marshall Enterprise, as I have banged the gavel on again and again in this particular podcast series, Fixing Fight Club. We're in tremendous trouble. When I say we're, I'm speaking as an American. We're in tremendous trouble when it comes to this massive, overpriced, brutally expensive, and terribly ineffective Marshall Enterprise between the services, joint coordination, and all of it. I would conclude by saying, I think that we can save money in the future. My plea would be, and again, we're speaking of the Air Force, is please, as the primary, and I know they're Space Force, but they are such a small service and they're doing so little to contribute to this. If they find a way to carve out defense, great. If they don't, I'll leave it to the Air Force. But the Air Force's primary job should be defending the nation. The nation's primary job should be reassessing and recalibrating by becoming a regional hegemon. That would be my recommendation, and that it's time for us to stop buying so many exquisite platforms. It is time for us to think that all platforms must be manned, and it is time for us to know that when it comes to affordable mass, when it comes to cheaper UAVs, UCAVs, those kind of things, to quote one of the most evil people of the 20th century, Stalin, quantity has a quality all its own. Thanks for listening. If you are an Air Force alumnus, I would love for you to correspond with me if I got anything wrong. Happy to hear it. Of course, I ask that you do so in a gentlemanly way. And to all my listeners, if you're listening for the first time, there's a whole host of, this is a companion podcast to Chasing Ghost and a Regular Warfare podcast. The very reason I took this on with War Notes was to take my umbrella rubric of a regular warfare and use this as a convenient way to discuss conventional warfare without muddying the waters over there. I have 57 episodes presently of that. This would be the, I suspect it's not the last episode of my Fixing Fight Club series. After I finish Fixing Fight Club, I will be doing occasional broadcasts on this, but I know that I want to get back to Chasing Ghosts because that's where I live, which is irregular warfare. And that's where I feel as if I have expertise in the Marshall Enterprise in much the comprehensivist fashion that, for instance, Jeremy Black does out of the UK, who is one of the finest military historians of our age. And I have lots to say, as you've probably noticed. So again, thank you for your listenership. Thank you for your solicitude. If you wish to get in touch with me, you can write me at cgpodcast@pm.me. That is cgpodcast@pm.me. I have a Substack. Paid subscriptions are available. I will never have my hat in hand asking for tips or anything like that. If you find you wish to give, that'll be great. If not, again, I appreciate your solicitude, your listenership, and paying attention to what I have to say, because I think we are at a critical path right now. I think that we are at a fork in the road to take the decision on where America is going to be as a military hegemon for the remainder of this century. So thanks again. This is Bill, out.